Today is June 7th, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. We are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, on the Internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time and on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York, on the radio at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Our website is pcradioshow.org. Our broadcasts are available for downloading from PRN.FM, WBAI.org, and our website, PCRadioshow.org. When WBAI is fundraising, we may be preempted by a replacement program, but we continue with a regularly scheduled weekly program on PRN.FM. And it's a beautiful day today in New York, and I'm happy to have Joe with me in the studio. He must be on some kind of health elixir. Where can I get that elixir, Joe?
It's odd, Hank, what was going on with me for the last few days or weeks. I got a prescription from my doctor that he said would really help me a great deal, and I went down to the local pharmacy, handed it to them. They looked up, punched something into their computer, came back and said, your copay is only $550.
Wow, you're kidding me, that much?
I said, what's that about? And he said, your insurance company won't pay for it. He said, you better check with your doctor. So I called the doctor the next day and I said, insurance company won't pay for it, you got to do something. He said, I'll appeal it, they'll approve it, don't worry. Day after that, woman from the doctor's office calls me and says, They won't approve it. So you can either it's a 5% of lidocaine, and she said, I know over the counter you can buy something with 4% of lidocaine. So I tried that and it worked, but it only worked for a few hours, and what they were going to give me would work for 12 hours. So I went on to my handy dandy internet. Hank, do you ever do that?
Not really. All my medicine, I've gotten it from the local drugstore, and in many cases, I've gone mail order, and I think the highest copay I ever paid was $20.
I've paid even a higher copay than that. But I thought maybe I could get it from a Canadian pharmacy or...
Now, wait a minute. You trust a Canadian pharmacy?
Absolutely, without question. Or a British pharmacy. They both are pretty notorious. I shouldn't say notorious. They're pretty well known for undercutting the U.S. price. But and I found this particular drug for about a third less. But at the bottom of that page on my monitor, I saw a thing that said Good RX, G-O-O-D, space RX, good prescription. So I went down to read it, and it said, you can save up to 50% or even more. Come to our site. And I went to their site and I found the following. They list over 6,000 prescriptions with the prices from thousands of local U.S. stores to the tune of millions of prices are up on their site. And each store and each price has a discount available. The discount is provided by the manufacturer, so you're not signing up for anything. It's not insurance. I plugged in the name of my prescription, and I plugged in my neighborhood, and I was given a choice of five or six different pharmacies, and the prices ranged quite a bit among those pharmacies. I picked the cheapest, which was a thing called Duane Reade, and I got a coupon for 50% off. took it downstairs to the pharmacy. I asked the pharmacist, does she honor that coupon? She said, absolutely, and gave me my prescription at 50% less.
Wait, I got to remember that URL. I mean, you know, people who depend on medicine, they really want to know what it is.
The URL, and you should never forget it, is goodrx.com. One word, goodrx. And Hank, you can get a membership card, although there's no membership information, and you can just walk into a pharmacy and use the card and very often get a significant discount. Or you can plug in the name of your specific drug, and they'll give you a coupon good for a specific pharmacy for that specific drug.
I have to remember that. But I just hope that I can stay healthy so I don't need all that high-cost medicine.
Well, I'll give you one suggestion to save a little more money on it. You can do I showed the coupon on my smartphone to the pharmacist. I didn't have to hand a paper coupon. She copied down what she needed, and there we go.
Oh, that's great. Hey, you know, it was in the news that there's a Chinese malware that's affecting 250 million computers. That is one quarter of a billion computers. That's a lot of computers that are being infected.
I want to know who counted them.
Well, it turns out that there is a download supplier, and I got to give you the name supplier. In other words, what they're saying is do not use that supplier. It's Rafotech, Rafotech. It's a major one, at least I know, in the Asian area. And what it is that they have to download software, and they don't realize that you go through sometimes very often a third party that, a lot of these programs you want to download, there's this small operation. They can't afford the website, with any heavy traffic.
Oh, you're saying this is a distributor of freeware.
Yes, and if you see that it's coming in from Rafotech, avoid it. Don't download it, because what it is that it infects the browsers you're using. And one of the questions that people are asking is, well, how do I know my browser is infected? Well, there's a whole lot of things that they ask. You know, was your homepage reset? Are your extensions there that you're not supposed? You know what? The safest thing to do is uninstall your browser and reinstall the browser again.
Well, that won't necessarily work, Hank, because when I uninstall my browser, I'm left with a lot of what they call mouse trails, what
yes.
I call garbage in my.
I'm experienced enough so that I manually know how to delete it. Although there are two areas that you have to delete, I only do one. The other one I could screw up, so I don't. One is there's a subdirectory name, and you could say, you know, one will say, Google Chrome, and, you know, if I'm reinstalling Chrome, I just delete everything in that subdirectory, the whole thing. What Google does, if you were to uninstall Chrome, is it leave parts of it in there, and, a lot of them do that, okay?
Well, it's not just that, Hank, and I've checked it manually myself. It'll all come off the hard disk. There's not a trace left of program X. But then in the registry.
Now, people say, what the heck do you mean by registry? Registry is a fancy word for operating parameters that are all lumped into one big file called registry. And if you got to be very careful of what you're doing, because if you screw that up, you can,
you got a paperweight.
Yeah. So, but I do this manually. And it can be very laborious. So I found that there's a website that to be quite good. It's called IOBIT Uninstall is the name of the program. So if you were to do a search on the name IOBIT Uninstaller, you'll come up with the website. There's also another one called Revo Uninstaller, Revo Uninstaller. And what that will do is not only does it clean up the so-called crap files in the subdirectory, but it also clean up the registry also.
And, will both of them do that or just the Revo?
No, both of them will do that. Now, of course, this is the free version, and if you want the pro version, they do more than that. They take care of ransomware and other things, and if you want to do that, fine. But at least the basic function of saying, I want to uninstall and reinstall is probably the quickest way. If you try to figure out whether or not you've been infected by it, you spend more time doing that than just uninstalling and reinstalling.
If you find that you're browser is going to a different home page, that's the first clue and the most important clue.
But what they do is, also, besides the being redirected, also they change the search engine. And one of the things I find is that some of these loaders will change it to ask, A-S-K. I don't want the ask search engine. I mean, I could see them changing to Bing, from Google to Bing.
Actually, I like ask better than Bing, but I prefer Google.
Well, now, I was getting ready for the show, and I said to myself, well, can you trust the downloading the a replacement browser? And I said to myself, you could probably use Internet Explorer, because it seems like no one wants to use it and no one really tries to infect it and download it. But you could download it with your existing one and before you uninstall it, so you have something. I just don't trust these downloaders, that's all.
One of the things, there are many things I do like, but one of the things I really don't like about Windows 10 is every time I use that's their browser,
right?
And it pops up a window saying, up at the top, do you want to use this new brand new one called Chrome? So I say yes, and they download Chrome, and I load Chrome, and it pops up a window and says, our browser Edge is better. Do you want to use our? And my computer's fighting with each other.
I know. But again, let me repeat. If the loader that is being used to download what you want, RAFOTECH, avoid that at all expense, because that's going to cause you nothing but misery later on.
How would people know they're getting that loader?
Normally, I would say that the loader would ask you, or you could see it, all right? In other words, if you start downloading a file, it doesn't even look close to the name of the file itself. Then you know, like CNET is a good example, okay? CNET, it used to be they download the files directly, and now you have to go through something called loader.com, and, you know.
Is that as bad as this other one that you talked about?
Well, so far, if you got to be careful with CNET when you do a download. Download.com used to be a site and everyone trusted, and now today you got to be careful because you got to go through answering questions. And the sneaky part is you got to be an English major because they use a double negative. You know what I mean by double negative?
Oh, yes.
You do not want. I mean, no, you don't want to want or something like that, and you know you end up saying yes to it. You know.
It's a problem. Hank is really saying to you, when you get your computer, not only don't download anything, but don't even plug it in, unless it's battery operated, and then you should remove the battery before you start using it.
Hey, Joe, you know, this week, this is a long lawsuit that's been running, and I'm kind of glad that after 8 years, I hope that doesn't have much more to go on. And a federal judge in Illinois ordered Dish Network to pay $280 million in fine for making robocalls. And I know that many people are very upset with robocalls, and they just, you know, it. It's a nuisance. It really is.
It goes beyond a nuisance. But this lawsuit, Hank told me about the outcome. And there were things about the news story that just bothered me. So I went back to read the underlying facts. And it's not as simple as some judge in Illinois decided that Dish should pay $250 million. This suit goes way back, as Hank said, 9 years. And it's not just... It's not just Dish. Yes, in the earliest days before the lawsuit came to a head, Dish did do some robocall marketing. But more than that, Dish sold or rented or leased the facilities to do robocall marketing to other companies. Those other companies, or at least some of those other companies, had a wonderful, wonderful list of phone numbers. It was called, the federal government provided it, and it was called the Do Not Call List.
Do Not Call List,
Do Not Call. And that was the main thrust of this lawsuit. Then after that all started, it seems that John Doe Company leased time and facilities from Dish. So the John Doe Company was part of the suit. But after a while, the suit got beyond that, where anybody who rented anything from Dish, if they did robocalling, it became Dish's fault. So that $250 million is, I don't think it's going to last after the Supreme Court does it, but I could be wrong.
Okay. Now, there's something new besides robocalls, and it hasn't hit you, Joe, but it has hit me. It's called ringless voicemail.
Yeah, I heard about that. I can only say whoever did it was really clever.
And by the way, there's no fix for it. There's no way
yet,
of...
Yet.
I don't know how they're going to fix it.
Well, I know how I can fix mine. Cancel my voicemail.
No, you cancel all messaging service. No, let's explain what it is first. What is ringless voicemail?
Where somebody in a distance can plant a message on your voicemail without your phone ringing first. It goes directly to voicemail. It bypasses the telephone. And that's, incidentally, what they're saying is the justification for not breaking the law. They said, we're not calling anybody on the do not call list. We're leaving them a message.
Now, I have a dentist that sent two messages to me like that to remind me that of my appointment and the time. So what's wrong with that?
Well, in my mind, it's very simple. Once this technology becomes known, right now only a few corporations are providing it. Once this technology becomes known, everybody and his twin brother are going to be using voiceless messaging. And they're going to fill my box with meaningless messages, you know, things like, you just won $18 zillion. If you call us, we'll tell you how to collect it. It's going to have the Nigerian 404. It's going to have 414. It's going to have everything imaginable. Now, at some point, Hank's granddaughter is going to get sick, and his daughter is going to call Hank and leave a message. Hank, it's very, very important you call me back. My daughter needs a ride to the hospital. And Hank is not going to get that message because he checks his mail, his voicemail regularly two or three times a day, and there's going to be 1,500 messages, and hers is going to be the 1,403rd message. He's never going to hear it. It's a very, very yes, I'm overstating it. Yes, I'm exaggerating, but this is really dangerous. Think of it differently. Suppose I could tie up your telephone with a busy signal all day long. That's what this is.
Well, let me ask you, is this something that carriers are offering or that the hackers have found a way of making it work that way?
Neither.
Neither?
Neither. This is a legit company who came up with a technology.
Oh, so some, okay, it's not a hacker, but a legit company came up with a way of doing it.
And they are selling the service. And right now they're selling the service to very, very few people. Now that it's made all the major media, or at least some of the major media, people are going to look at it and say, hey, that's a great way of doing business. And they're going to call this company, and they're going to do it also. Someplace along the line, companies that are on the border of legality and illegality are going to start doing it also. Oh. You can't put something back in Pandora's box once it's been opened, but you can change the law.
Well, do you think you can live without messaging service?
No.
Oh. Why not just have someone call you? They say,
Can't do that. Suppose my phone is busy.
Okay. So, well, right now, I was sad to say that there is no fix.
That we know of. If any of you do know of a fix, pass it along, and we'll pass it along. In the meantime, I'm going to keep looking for one for myself, and if I find it, if you're really nice and ask sweetly, I'll try and tell you what I did.
You know, Joe, one of the things that we used to do, and until the about half a year ago, because of logistics at WBAI, where we really didn't have any phones to use, we used to have listeners call in, and it was great. We got great feedback, and we knew what they want, and
Hank,
they told us.
I still remember an awful lot of those listeners on a first-name basis. We had the same people call us over the last 35 years. We became friends with them. I don't want to use any of their names, but Gary, you know who I'm thinking of.
And Tom.
And
Banjo Lady, remember?
Yeah,
I mean, they got nicknames, too.
Right, and we became friendly with them over the airwaves. Then one day, some genius at our station decided telephones were not a requirement for talk show
radio.
Well,
other than under FCC law, you must have one phone line in the studio. And that was it.
And with one phone line, forget it. That type of call-in radio disappeared.
Well, what I like to do, I just want to say this, is that if anyone – see, the thing is, I don't know how many people are listening to this broadcast
live.
Live, and we're on Eastern Time from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. And if there's enough people, let me know. And you know what I would like to do? Tell me who you are, and we'll call you. But it's got to be that within that 6 to 7 p.m. time frame, and maybe we can set it up to go back to that mode again so that we, you know, like this item here that we're talking about, the way they give you these ringless messages, I think people may want to comment on that.
I do, too. So if you sent us a letter at, let's use the Gmail address, Hank, pcradio@gmail. Easy enough to remember. pcradio, that's personal computer radio, at Gmail. pcradio@gmail.com. And tell us, we do require a name. Give us your first name. Give us the phone number you want us to call you at.
And if possible, where do you live? Just a city, so we have some idea where the listeners are.
Exactly. You know. And I can't promise you that we will call you. I can't promise you at what time we'll call you. I can't promise you that somebody won't call just to check the validity of the line.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing bad will happen to you if you do that.
Okay. Now let's talk about Apple's big announcement where they invented more technology. They invented an amazing Siri speaker system.
What they did, and before we tell you what they invented, I got to disabuse Hank of his very negative attitudes towards such a wonderful organization.
Wait a minute. I said these are great inventors.
Sorry, but I'm looking at your face, and I can see your body language. The folks, unless they smooth out their TV sets, they can't do that. You know, Hank, what would you say is the most famous thing that Apple invented?
The Newton?
How about the iPhone?
No, they didn't invent that.
They didn't invent the iPhone?
No.
When was the iPhone invented?
Back in the 90s, and I think there was either Motorola or Ericsson.
Right, and you're absolutely right. But what Steve Jobs, may he rest in peace.
Wait, they invented the computer.
What Steve Jobs, may he rest in peace, did do, and he did do excellently, he found things that other people had invented but didn't maximize their value, didn't really know what to do with them, or in his opinion didn't. And he would take that concept, that engineering invention, and he would develop it into something far more and far greater than he had ever expected.
Well, there were two things that is common in all the products that Apple come up with. Number one is fit and finish. And if you have the best fit and finish, you're going to get attention. And the second was marketing.
Yes, but before we...
By the way, I said marketing. I didn't say religion, did I?
Before we even get to that, what he did was he could see a concept and know somehow intuitively that that was a fantastic thing, but it had to change in order to be really fantastic. And when he stood up on that stage all those many times and said, I would like to introduce you to X, it's fantastic... He meant it was fantastic, and it was fantastic when he first showed the iPhone, when he first showed the iPod, the iPad, the...
Well, now they have a home pad.
So now Steve is no longer with us, and Tim Cook looked around the marketplace and said, what's new and exciting that nobody has? And he came up with a concept. The Alexa and the Alexa Dot?
Now, wait a minute. Amazon owns that.
Yes, but how many people do you have one?
Not yet.
Do I have one?
I think you do.
No, I don't.
No, you don't.
And that's what Tim Cook said. It's a great product, but nobody I know has it.
Now,
wait a minute. What he did was said, what is it lacking? What's the biggest thing that was lacking in that product? The name Apple.
And who's going to pay $350 for it?
People who know that Apple gives them good engineering, good design, good product, and good service. Service more than anything else. I've got to tell you, Hank, I've had a lot of experience with customer relations and customer service, and nobody comes close to Apple. You can take any of my Apple products that I use myself, my wife's iPhone, my iPod. The fit and finish of them, the manufacturing of them is absolutely the best. Nobody even comes close. Some people try, but they don't. So when he came up with this speaker product, the first thing that he said is what Amazon is missing is Apple. And the only way we can give them Apple on that product is by doing more and better than they've already done. Now, I'm not saying what they succeeded at. I'm saying that's what they were aiming for. So instead of Alexa has a personal, whatever they call it, a voice. So Apple already has a voice. They use it on their computer products. It's called Siri. So Siri is now part of the Apple Home item. But there's one thing that Apple has that a lot of other people don't really understand. Then that's the whole concept of life around Apple.
They call it ecosystem.
And the Apple ecosystem says we don't use anybody else's stuff. We only use Apple stuff. So you know what you need if you have this new Apple Home speaker? You got to subscribe to Apple Music. It won't play Amazon Music.
Well, you got to remember two things, Joe, is that it's also double the price of the best unit that Amazon has. And I don't know if...
That's not a bad thing for Apple, is it?
Well, let me ask you, with the iPhone, it dominated the market at one time, and its market share now has become less and less each year.
It didn't dominate the market. You had told me that, and I believed you because I always believe whatever obscure fact you come up with. But this time I decided to look. And when the iPhone came out, they were thrilled, absolutely thrilled, when they had 18% of the market.
Well, let me put it this way. Only time will tell whether this succeeded or not. But one of the things I did want to talk about very quickly before we run out of time is that the New York Times, both Monday, the last 2 days, said that Apple's really trying to reinvent itself. And one of the things that Steve Wozniak said is that Apple's lost its mojo, and he thinks that the leading technology company is Tesla.
Yeah, I didn't read that particular quote, but I do know that Woz really thinks highly of the Tesla.
Elon Musk.
Elon Musk has come up. He thinks a lot of Elon Musk the same way he personally felt about Steve Jobs, that the man knows. Somehow the man knows and knows what he doesn't know. He goes out and finds people to back him up, and what he knows, he knows marketing, he knows technology, and he knows what could sell. He said in that same article, Woz said that the very next company to be successful in space is not going to be anybody you think about, but it is going to be Elon Musk.
Well, I think that with the Apple announcement, I noticed that if you look at the totality of all the announcements that they made, is that they're moving towards iOS as the standard operating system, not only for the iPhone, but also for eventually the MacBooks, because MacBook sales has really gone way down. So we'll see. But I think that, as what the New York Times said, they are reinventing themselves. And the question is, I think Tim Cook has to do more than just, you know, reinventing. He's got to come up with some innovation, too. Well, like one of the things that Steve Jobs had brought up that has never come to fruition is the TV, the Apple TV. It's still sitting around.
I could have sworn that Apple TV was for sale.
No. Not in the way that you see what Netflix is doing and what Amazon is doing.
No, not up to their standards at all. As a matter of fact, Hank, do you know I was watching Netflix on my smartphone?
Okay, good. And we do have a couple of very interesting segments coming up, and I think you'll be quite interested in hearing about it, and let's get to it. We have three feature segments tonight. The first is Health Technology by Dr. Alfred Poor, and he'll be talking about augmenting the human body, exoskeleton harness, and biocompatible capacitor for implants. I have an op-ed on renewing your domain registration, and Marty Winston will be having his segment on home automation, which he'll talk about where backup is not infinite.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. Tonight, I want to start off with a pair of stories about augmenting the human body. One of the most common ways of augmenting the human body that we see every day just about is the wheelchair. It allows people who don't have complete use or any use in some cases of their legs, gives them the ability to move about on their own and be independent. But one of the problems with a wheelchair is reaching things that are up high. It's a simple matter for somebody who's standing, but for somebody who's confined to a sitting position, it's a real challenge to get around lots of places. Imagine going to the library and the books that you want aren't on the bottom few shelves. The Center for Bionic Medicine is designing a new kind of wheelchair that they call the manual standing wheelchair. It doesn't have battery power or motors. It's still powered by the individual person, but unlike a regular wheelchair where your hand motion can only be used to propel the chair forward or backward, this chair has a lever that you can throw. When you crank the wheels for the wheelchair, it actually raises the user to a standing position. There's braces around the knees and around the lap to steady the person and prevent falls. And then once they're standing, you throw the lever again. You can then move the chair forward and backwards and wheel around as you normally would when you're seated. So this chair gives people who don't have the ability to control their legs, it lets them stand up, move around, and access things that would normally be out of reach. The other story about augmenting the human body also doesn't require electric motors or batteries or anything like that. It basically is an exoskeleton that harvests the energy of the person who's wearing it, takes energy from one kind of motion and stores it to be used as another kind of motion. This is a new harness that's been designed by the home improvement chain Lowe's. They actually have their own Lowe's Innovation Labs where they work on technology projects such as this. And they were looking for a way to help their workers in their stores lift heavy objects and carry them around without getting fatigued, without lifting dangerously and increasing the risk of injury. What they did was they created a harness that goes from the shoulders all the way down to the thighs. And then they made these flexible rods made out of carbon fiber. And these are attached to this structure, this frame that they wear. So when they bend forward, there's actually resistance from these rods. They have to exert a little extra effort to bend forward. But once they are bent over, that creates stored energy. And when they go to lift up an object and they straighten up, they get that energy back again. It's returned to them, and it makes it easier for them to stand up and carry the heavy objects that they might have to carry. This project is being done in collaboration with students from Virginia Tech, and it's already being used in one of their stores in Virginia. If it proves out to be an improvement and helps the workers, Lowe's has plans to roll it out more widely throughout all their stores. My third piece today does have something to do with electricity and health tech. One of the problems with implants, especially objects like heart pacemakers and things like that that require power, the problem is that they tend to use batteries, which can be very reliable, but nonetheless are still made out of highly toxic materials and have to be sealed up carefully to make sure that they don't get loose in the body. An additional problem is that the batteries eventually run out of power and need to be replaced, which can require invasive surgery or other procedures. So one of the things that scientists have been looking for is a biocompatible device that can store electricity for implants such as a pacemaker. Researchers at UCLA and the University of Connecticut have worked together to create a supercapacitor made from biocompatible materials. Now, a supercapacitor is a little different than a regular battery. A battery typically uses a chemical process and electrolytes to store electricity, and there's an actual change in the chemical makeup of the battery as electricity is added or withdrawn. Batteries tend to be able to hold a lot of power over a long period of time, but it takes relatively long time to discharge or to recharge the battery. In contrast, a capacitor is an electronic device that's solid state. There's no moving parts. A charge builds up on one side and can be stored, and that can be released very quickly if needed. So it's very fast to charge, very fast to discharge. But in the past, they haven't been able to store as much energy as a battery can. A supercap, a supercapacitor or a supercap, has the best of both. And what they've done is they've come up with a way of using microscopically thin layers of graphene, which is a single molecule thick sheet of carbon atoms. They combine this with modified human proteins that are used as the electrolyte in the supercapacitor. It's just carbon and human protein, so it's totally compatible with the human body. No toxic materials involved. This energy storage device is only 1 micrometer thick, which is much, much less than the thickness of a human hair. And it's flexible and it's lightweight, and it can bend and twist, so can easily adapt within the body and not cause problems by being some rigid device that's implanted in there. The idea is that this kind of supercap technology could be paired with an energy harvesting device, perhaps using motion or some other kind of energy to convert into electricity, and then that electricity could be stored in the supercap for later use by the implanted device. This supercap approach could be used not just for pacemakers, but for other kinds of implants, and could end up by providing energy for the lifetime of the person and never have to be replaced. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Renewing a domain name. You have a registered domain name and it's time for renewal. You had been notified by the original registrant that it's time to renew. There is no problem with that, especially if you had registered the domain name 5 years ago. In fact, the reminder is appreciated. You call them up and ask where to send a check. I had this episode with GoDaddy. For domain renewal, however, GoDaddy requires payment by credit card. Okay, I took out my credit card, but it wasn't enough. This too was rejected because this is not the same credit card used 5 years ago. There was an alternative, however, and that's to send an email that you had want to pay with a new credit card, but you need to use the email address at the time of registration. Well, I had changed over from Earthlink to Fios, so I now use a Gmail account. According to GoDaddy operating procedures, they must receive the request from the original email used. But I told them the account is no longer active. GoDaddy said, well, there's another way of doing it and authenticating who I am, and that is to make a request at www.changeupdate.com, which is managed by ICANN. So I went over to the ICANN site. It says, regain access to my account or my domain. Before proceeding with this form, we suggest you gather the required information. You'll be asked to upload a scan of your government-issued photo ID. If a company is listed on your account, business documentation of your company is required. I dutifully followed the instructions and received a response 3 days later. Our support staff has responded to your request, details of which are described below. And then there's a section called Discussion Notes, blank. And there's another section that says Support Staff Response. We see you recently submitted a change update request. We're sorry, but we can only make this change after verifying the consent of the registrant, and unfortunately, the registrant's consent was not provided in this case. What now?
If you still want to pursue this action, you might consider the following. 1. Trying to resolve the issue directly with the current registrant. You should be able to find the contact information in the Who Is directory. 2. Consulting an ICANN-approved arbitrator. Please review the following link. Provide your legal counsel with the following link for information about submitting legal documents to GoDaddy. And the second is, well, go get a subpoena. We hope this was helpful. Good luck. My reaction? Go hire legal counsel or obtain a subpoena. GoDaddy should let people know that at time of registration for renewal, what information will be required. If I can get on a plane with a government-issued photo ID, why is that not good enough as it was requested?
I had updated the domain name registration on whois.com, but GoDaddy never updated their original information, so the latest email address valid with ICANN is not valid with GoDaddy. You can't win, and if you want to fight it, it can be a very lengthy process, and someone else may jump in and claim the domain name. So I went through tax records of 5 years ago to see if the credit card number may have been part of documentation claiming an itemized deduction. Well, I'm glad I found it. Called back GoDaddy with the old account number, and I was then able to renew the domain name. There are lessons to be learned. 1. Is to write down and save all information when a domain name is registered. And the second is, when it comes time to renew, don't wait till the last minute because you may not have enough time to do it. Presenting Marty Winston on Home Automation.
Hank's advice to back up is excellent advice as far as it goes. We're learning some things with our 40-year house project, 40yearhouse.com, that suggest backup might be better and might not. Backup isn't infinite. You don't want to do without it. You need to have some. For example, we decided not to have any batteries, no batteries, because we're, like almost everybody else, terrible at babysitting batteries. A battery goes bad, how do you know it? Really, and if you've got thousands of things with batteries in them, how do you identify the one with the bad battery? So we're doing DC feeds in the house, and we're doing it, as I've said before, by taking the output of a power supply unit, a PSU, the kind that is in the back of, or the bottom of a PC system unit, and powering that with a UPS that's plugged into the power line that's on a backup generator. And on the DC voltage lines that this is providing, there are six of these in little green plywood boxes, not that little, about 12 by 12, six of these in the attic of the house, and each feeds a 14-4 cable going out from center in both directions. And we split it down the middle so that we could put devices on both sides and the current load would be split. We're dealing with thereby less resistance to endpoint, smaller voltage drops. Happy electrical engineering, everybody. One thing we're doing at the far end of each of those cables is to take the three voltages, happen to be 3.35 and 12, and put a 1,000 microfarad capacitor between that voltage and the common ground. Ground is ground, the common ground they all share. By doing that, we get the ability to support sudden surges in demand that are beyond the capacity of the PSU, and very brief, or in a power outage that lasts only milliseconds, that can hold that voltage up. A capacitor charges rapidly enough and discharges more slowly according to the current demand it sees. So a capacitor acts like a little tiny, very temporary battery, and that's one level of backup we have that is measured in maybe milliseconds. The time it takes for one of the standby power supplies to switch over and power that power supply unit delivering those DC voltages is 4 milliseconds. So I think we've got that gap pretty well covered. The time it takes a generator to kick in might be as long as a couple of minutes. But each of the UPSs that's handling those power supply units is capable of several minutes of support. So that is covered. But what if a disaster takes out the natural gas supply that's powering the generators? Well, this isn't a bunker. This isn't a species survival pod. It's not a fallout shelter. There are points at which we have to surrender ourselves to circumstance. Backup isn't infinite. It needs to be finite because without that, it's enormously expensive. But it can't be zero and it shouldn't be unitary. You need to have some level of backup. I also want to suggest that if that major disaster takes out both electricity and the gas supply, we have other concerns. Electricity runs the well pump. We won't have water to drink. We won't have water to flush. We won't have water to bathe. We do have an internal tank in the house design that's in the attic, holds a couple of hundred gallons, and that might be a temporary source of water, but it is deliberately not easy to get at, and the pump that's normally on it requires, again, electricity. So if the pump can't run, that means we don't have water. The gas not running means that we don't have heat. We can't cook. No gas, no electricity. I guess we could build a campfire, but we're stuck. There's nothing in the house that's going to run until one or the other of those gets fixed. Let's go back to the generator for a minute. You know, ours is on natural gas, and you might say, well, there's liquid propane. Why not put in a big liquid propane tank and let, you know, that cover it if natural gas goes away? Get a dual fuel generator. Well, the answer is the biggest residential propane LPG tanks won't keep a generator going, as I understand it, even a full day, let alone several days. So that is not going to be a solution. Best solution is probably get in the car, go somewhere else, stay in a hotel till it passes over. The septic tank in the house, I might add, is not directly affected. Its aerator won't run, so it's not going to digest stuff as quickly as it might if there were power. But then again, that's kind of irrelevant because with the toilets not flushing, nothing much is being added to it. When you deal with what you deal with every day, you can plan for a layer or two, sometimes three. But there are limits. In our case, we want to extend some consideration to a common household to prevent inconvenience, to prevent the need to deal with crises as being extra critical. But there's only so far you can go. And by the way, I mentioned heat. This is a very, very, very well-insulated house design. It's going to lose heat or cooling much more slowly than a standard home. I'm guessing yours is not going to have that benefit. So as you think about this stuff, think about the reality of the four walls that you're inside. I'm not going to tell you to go and blow things in the walls and all of that. You'll figure that out for yourself. Maybe you'll move. Maybe you'll build a house. Maybe you'll copy ours. All of that's fine. In terms of your gear, you'll have power in your mobile gear for a while. You may be able to recharge it in the car. That may be okay. Good for you. That doesn't mean the cell tower is going to be up. You may have to leave town to get at that. You won't have internet communications other than through the phone or maybe your car. You won't have the ability... Well, you may have the ability to make a landline call. You won't necessarily. Backing up the phone lines is something you may want to consider. And you will not have locked doors if electricity plays any role in your door security. You're also going to have, many of you, animals that need care. And that is a very separate consideration that you need to accommodate. When's the last time you were on a camping trip? When infrastructure goes away, that's kind of what you're left with. Do you have matches? Do you have blankets? Do you have candles? Do you have flashlights? Do you have extra batteries for things? Those are some of the concerns that are going to come back to the fore as you head back into the 1700s and 1800s at home or at the office. There's one other thing I'm going to suggest to you. For those of you who insist on getting some work done despite the fact you've got no gear to get it done with, Keep pencils and paper around. You can be surprisingly effective with those. I will also tell you, keep your ears open. In a widespread emergency, the public servants, the first responders, are going to do everything they can to communicate with everyone in the public. As soon as there are cures en route, solutions en route, remedies en route, responses en route, they're going to try to let you know. They're going to try to give you advice on what to do. Backup only goes so far, but it does go so far that you shouldn't do without it. Backup, backup, backup. And back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Marty. The following are public service announcements for the regional area. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing will have a presentation on smartphone ride services Thursday, June 8th. That's tomorrow, 2017, at 2 p.m. at the Community Room located at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on Easy Does It, creating a multimedia presentation Thursday, that's also tomorrow evening, June 8, 2017 at 7 p.m. at NYU 65th Avenue, that's near 12th Street, room 150. Note, this is a temporary change of location for this month. Meeting is at Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be meeting on Friday, June 9, 2017, and they will meet at the New York Institute of Technology at Old Westbury Campus, Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, auditorium of the Harry J. Schur Hall. Rockland PC Users Group will be meeting on Tuesday, June 13, 2017. The meeting time is 7:15 p.m. Rasser Room, the Palisades Mall on the fourth floor in West Nyack, New York. Kingsbite Computer Club will have a presentation on the future of computers. Their meeting time is Tuesday, June 13, 2017. Meeting time is 7 p.m. They will meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn, New York. Princeton PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, June 27, 2017, Community Room of the Princeton Public Library, Princeton, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group will be meeting on Thursday, June 29, 2017 at 6:45 p.m. Topic of presentation is Tune Up Your Windows PC. They meet at Middletown Library, Large Community Room in Middletown, New Jersey. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will be meeting on Friday, July 7th, 8 p.m. They meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bardo Avenue, Scotch Plains, New Jersey. These meetings are all open to the public free of charge, and they hope to see you there one day. The website for the Personal Computer Show is pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at PCRadio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York on the radio, or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and back up, and of course back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.